Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. It was closer than supporters would have liked, but voters say yes to the transit referendum, and Mayor Lyles is raring to get underway.
It starts right now.
And following a pattern that took place in elections nationwide, Democrats run the table. That means there will be one lone Republican in local government. National politics also begins to impact Charlotte, with the FAA cutting flights at major airports, including ours, as the government shutdown drags on and as three North Carolina Republican congressmen call for the governor to deploy the National Guard in Charlotte. CMPD introduces its new chief. Estella Patterson starts at the first of the year, is raring to go, and happy to be here.
I am ecstatic.
And Charlotte FC and the Panthers fans were ecstatic. After last weekend's wins, Charlotte FC's playoff hopes will end or continue tonight. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE politics reporter Steve Harrison. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ben Thompson is morning anchor at WCNC-TV. And Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV Channel 9. Well, in a vote, good morning and welcome, everybody. I should say that.
Good morning.
In a vote that was closer than transit plan proponents would have liked, voters on Tuesday said yes, as I said, to the 1% sales tax for transit referendum. Robert McCutcheon is the CEO of one of the biggest supporters of the plan, the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance.
So tonight, we don't just celebrate a win, we celebrate a promise to move forward together. Thank you for your trust, thank you for a vision, and thank you for believing that Charlotte's best days are ahead. Thank you.
And the excitement is overwhelming. This effort started about 5 years ago in earnest, and the results will take about, I'm told, a decade. So is this the end of the beginning of what has been called the single biggest source of new infrastructure funding in our history, Steve?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair way to put it. I think that we're going to enter kind of a lull for the next 3 or 4 years, where, you know, there will be some money spent on new buses and roads and sidewalks and bike lanes and things like that. But in terms of the most visible pieces of this, like the trains, the rail transit, that's going to be a ways off. I mean, the Red Line, even if everything goes well, the city says probably won't open for 8 to 10 years.
So we're going to start paying 1% more in sales tax. The sales tax will go up to 8.25%. Joe, what will this get us?
Well, the split is 40 for roads, 40 for rail, 20 for bus. First project that will have to be done for rail is the Red Line from uptown to somewhere up north. That's to be determined. And no other rail project can start till 50% of that is done. So we're looking at 8 to 10 years probably for the Red Line. And so there'll be a bit of a holding pattern for rail until a good chunk of that project gets going. And then I think the first thing you'll see are the bus improvements and the road improvements. They want to increase the frequency, buy more buses, improve the roads. They're going to be talking about the road improvement money on Monday already, so they're getting that ball rolling.
This was an off-year election, but turnout was far greater than normal. And for Charlotte teacher Sam Harding, the referendum was the biggest draw on the ballot.
I believe that public goods like light rails and public transportation is very important to a community, and so I'm okay with paying a 1% tax increase if it actually goes and starts to benefit the good of the people.
So Steve, what were the final vote totals?
So it was 52% in favor of the referendum, 48% against. I think a little bit closer than the yes from EC, the pro-transit supporters thought, but of course, you know, in an election, close only counts and hand grenades, so it doesn't matter. The tax passed, a huge accomplishment for the transit and transportation promoters.
So what about voter turnout overall?
Just under 22%. I looked on the Board of Elections website. I can't find the turnout numbers end if for off-year elections at 2015. It was the highest for at least a decade, probably the highest for many, many years.
And voters around the country came out in droves in Virginia, in New Jersey, in New York City, in Los Angeles, well, in California. Voters surged to the polls. Pundits have said that this was in response to actions being taken by the very unpopular Trump administration. Turnout was the highest here, as you said, since, I think, what would you say, 2015?
At least 2015, yeah.
Can we point to dissatisfaction with the Trump administration for the higher than normal voter turnout here, Ben, or and for the Democratic sweep on the Charlotte City Council, or is it simply that the voters came out to vote for or against the transit?
I mean, I think the transit, it was a big motivator for a lot of people here. You can't discount when you do look at City Council and you do look at the CMS board. Clearly, Democrats had a good night nationally and locally as well. But the transit is something that, you know, we've been covering, we've all been covering now, going on years and years and years. And I do think it was top of mind, especially considering the incidents on the light rail over the summer and discussions of crime. There was no one who was not talking about transit in this city for one reason or another.
We've been talking about it forever, but it seems that when we finally got permission from the legislature to have this referendum, it almost seemed like they weren't ready for that yes answer, because the whole idea of building up to this didn't seem to be very, this is just an impression, it didn't seem to be very coordinated. There were concerns that this plan was so significantly altered by the General Assembly that it won't accomplish what planners say we need, and others worried that the increase in the sales tax, being a regressive tax, would hurt low-income people the hardest, and the people on the east side of Charlotte and in Matthews felt shortchanged by the plan, altered because they eliminated the Silver Line train to much of that area and replaced it with bus rapid transit. Jesse Capel is an east side resident who voted no.
Unfortunately, I don't feel like the administration focuses enough on our side of town, so the southeast side of town. We don't get the attention that we need, and I don't like that the plans that were submitted most recently don't really address the needs of here.
So the plan will bring, as I said, bus rapid transit to the east side, to Matthews and other parts of the east side of Charlotte, but it will also provide money for local roads and other transportation projects. Could people on that side of town be pleasantly surprised when all is said and done with some of the things coming their way? Joe, you're nodding yes.
Yeah, because like I said, I mean, who the heck knows what's going to be built here? The decisions are going to be made by a 27-member board of the MPTA. The southeast part of Charlotte is going to see bus and road projects. And we won't even, talk about another rail project being built for maybe 10 years. So who knows? Some elected official's kid might be serving on that board or mayor by now, by then. So we don't know really what rail projects, what costs are going to look like, if anything other than the Red Line is going to be built, truthfully. So who knows?
Speaking of costs, I think $3 million was spent by proponents of this referendum to encourage people to say yes. The Charlotte Regional Business Alliance spent at least $1.7 million to promote a yes vote. And when former Charlotte mayor and former governor Pat McCrory was on this program on Wednesday, he mentioned he had only received one mailer promoting a yes vote. So did I. One mailer the whole time. Although he is a supporter of the plan and the man who pushed very hard for the building and implementation of the Blue Line, he's worried that there wasn't overwhelming support for this.
They're going to have to do this right. And that's why my concern is having under 55% or whatever the vote is, there are going to be people watching what happens. And so I think it's going to be a greater challenge than I had and people following me had in the 90s and early 2000s.
He mentioned that although voters said yes to this, and although there is no sunset on this tax, if these projects don't deliver, unhappy citizens, he said, could start a movement to end the tax at some point. Is that really possible? Mary.
Listen,
Mary.
Yeah, Mary first. Back in 2007, we did have sort of a recall election on the original half-cent sales tax for transportation, for lack of a better way of putting it. That effort did fail. There was another push a few years later to get it back on the ballot again. It did not make it onto the ballot that time. So in theory, it is a plausible thing. It did happen once before a while back now, and voters voted to stick with the tax at the time.
Ben, you want to add to that?
I just say you can't get over the fact, and you can't understate the fact that, you had a Democrat-dominated city council and a Republican-dominated General Assembly, along with the different stakeholders in the different towns around Mecklenburg County, agree on something. That is like threading the, you know, the tiniest of threads to a needle. And so I feel like a lot of city leaders are relieved they got through that part. And going forward, not to say these projects are going to be easy, because they won't be, but I think that was a Herculean effort already.
And Joe, you had your hand up before Pat McCrory finished speaking, so I know you have something to say. I hope.
Yeah, if Pat wants my 9 mailers, he can have them, because I got a ton of them, and now they are being transformed into something at a recycling plant in Mecklenburg County. But it was interesting, all of the mailers were focused on the roads, and I asked about that after it passed, and it's basically because road money consistently pulls higher than rail and bus projects. So that's why everything you heard was about street improvements.
And yet, from the results that the analysis of the results that I've been reading about, it is young people who help push this over the top. And it's young people in and around the inner core who want rail. Is that accurate?
Yeah, some of the highest performing precincts for the referendum were in Noda, Uptown, and Southend. Those are areas that are already pretty familiar with rail. You've got the Blue Line, the Gold Line, running through some of those areas. And precincts that skewed younger tended to break more for the referendum. You also saw a really high performing precinct up in Davidson, which is obviously an area that's been waiting for the Red Line for a really long time. So seems like just based on that data, you know, that you could correlate that an affinity for rail could have been a motivating factor. And obviously, as Joe said, you know, roads was a big part of the campaign's messaging, especially in the southeast part of the county that was more skeptical because of everything that went down with the Silver Line. And looking at the data, it doesn't seem like that was necessarily the most effective message. The referendum's worst performance by far and away was in those precincts in and around Matthews that have been really burned for a while now about everything that went down with the Silver Line.
So proponents of this effort spent about $3 million. There was organized opposition. They spent about $6,000 to encourage people to vote no, mostly in Black communities. Did that have an impact in those communities? Do we know?
The referendum overall in most majority Black precincts did pass. It didn't pass with large numbers. It would be around low 50s in support. But I think that the opposition did a pretty effective job in getting to 48%. It was kind of guerrilla warfare, you know, and they were able to get the conversation started and make it okay for people and elected officials and other leaders to come out and say they were against it. For $6,000, it was a pretty remarkable campaign.
Yeah. Mary just mentioned that the people in Southend, Noda, and Uptown voted primarily yes for this initiative. Where was the opposition? Was there significant opposition? Can you point to areas of town where they really did say no?
Yeah, absolutely. Matthews, Mint Hill, East Charlotte, parts of East Charlotte, Matthews, Mint Hill. Honestly, a lot of precincts in Tricia Cotham's part of town, and she was the reason why this is on the ballot, and Ken McCool is running against her and was opposed to it, so we are going to hear about this in about a year as well.
Mary, 30
seconds. One thing that stuck out to me in the data, too, was up in North Mecklenburg. If you look at sort of a map, you can see where I-77 cuts through on the side of 77, where they're going to be getting the red line. A lot of precincts broke for the referendum. On the other side, you had a lot of precincts where the referendum didn't get over the hump with 50%. So sort of an interesting divide up there in North Mech also, that seemed to, you know, maybe a little bit of correlation between who is getting the red line and who isn't.
When we come back, a few more things to talk about with regard to the referendum and other race results in and around Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison, our WFAE political reporter, is with us, along with Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and Ben Thompson from WCNC-TV. We know the outcome of the vote on transit. When will the tax go into effect, Ben?
That's when everything's going to start moving, and that's July 1st of next year. That's around also the same month that some of the local towns are going to start to get some of their money for the road improvements. So if you're looking for a difference maker that's going to happen, if you voted for this, look at next summer, because then after that, to Steve's point earlier, it's going to be a bit before we get those better buses, increased frequency of some of the buses, 50% more increased service. That's going to be probably more 3 to 5 years.
So buy everything expensive you need now before July. How will this affect individuals? How it will affect individuals will depend, of course, on your spending habits. And officials say that the average Mecklenburg County household will face about $240 extra in sales taxes to bring in that $19 billion over the next 30 years. But there will be no additional sales tax on food, on medicine, and a few other categories. And on Wednesday, Mayor Vial Iles was asked a key question.
I know some of you are asking probably what happens next. When does this start? So why don't we go ahead and say it starts right now.
So what are those first steps? What will we see happen first? Joe.
So today, the city of Charlotte's going to send a press release at some point and list the 27 finalists for the MPTA. That is going to be the next acronym we all have to memorize, and they will make the determinations about what projects will basically be implemented. There are 27 members of this board. The city gets to appoint 12 of them, and 7 of the picks will come from Charlotte City Council of those 12. So 27 people will be interviewed next week. On November 17th, we will find out which 12 people will be appointed to the board.
But when does work begin on the red line, the silver line, the other things that are in this plan? Do we know, Steve?
Yeah, the key next step in the red line is that the authority will have to hire an engineering firm to do a detailed work on how to build it. You know, this idea of like getting to 30% design is a key metric. Right now, they expect the red line will cost $1.4 billion. Just judging on the history of all projects everywhere, that will probably go up. And then we'll get a sense of how many people they think will ride it. And that will start to give us a sense of the key. A key milestone will be, will the federal government pay for half of the construction costs? That's what they're counting on. If the federal government doesn't come through, that has a domino effect and it just kills other projects.
Shortly after the vote on Wednesday, Mayor Lyles talked about when this would all get underway.
The rail projects are already in design and will move quickly, with major progress expected within the next decade. The Red Line, a long-awaited project, will finally move forward.
So, as you said, Steve, 10 years and a lot of money for consultants for a line that the track for which is already in place. Why can't they just buy vehicles and run them? Steve or Joe? Joe, go ahead. You had your hand up.
Okay. Well, there's a lot. They need to redesign it, essentially, because the last time they put it through design was a long time ago and things have changed. So they need to pretty much restart that whole process. We don't know where the line is going to end. Probably people don't realize we've been saying like uptown to Iredell County, but Iredell County hasn't said whether they want that to happen, and they have to like grant that authority. And then the PAVE Act literally says the line can't end in Davidson unless Davidson holds a vote and says that's fine, we're fine with the line ending there. So they're gonna have to design different parts of towns have established where they want their stops to be now. We got to factor that in. We have to figure out if Camp North End is going to get a stop. And if they do, if another stop will have to be removed. So in a lot of ways, we kind of are starting from scratch, but at least we own the tracks.
Yeah. So Steve, you've done a lot of reporting over the last several years on ridership levels and who rides what and when and how and why. And there are 157 people who move to Charlotte, we are told, on every single day. Commuters are spending a record 64 hours annually stuck in traffic. That's 11 more hours than they were stuck in traffic in 2019. Do we know what kind of an impact in a decade that this will have when these projects start to come online if the current levels of people moving here continue at those levels?
I think that's hard to say. I think the best way to describe the transportation plan is choice. In that, you know, let's say if the Red Line is built, it gives North Mecklenburg commuters a choice. You know, you can use the express toll lanes and drive, you can use the regular lanes, you can use the train, you can use bus. I think choice is the key thing. The idea of there being less congestion, a noticeable difference on congestion, either from today's levels or in the future, I don't really see that happening. But I think choice is the main thing. You have different options to get to work.
And as you mentioned, the first thing to happen will be the beginning of the selection of the 27-member committee that will take control of CATS under this new plan. The city will give up control, and this new organization will take control. 27 members seems a bit unwieldy. And when he was on the program this week, Pat McCrory wondered how this will work in terms of where the buck will stop. Will it stop with the director of CATS? Will it stop with the chairman of this new committee? Does anybody know the answer to that question? Joe?
I think CATS is going to go away. I think it's going to all fall under MPTA. I don't know what we're going to call buses. I asked Malcolm Graham that question, and he said, I don't know. I don't know if we'll even still call it CATS a couple of years from now, if there'll be the MPTA bus. That doesn't have a ring to it. But they're going to really push all the public transit under this authority. And the reason the 27 member board is so large is because the state lawmakers wanted to make sure everyone has a seat at the table, everyone has a say. That's why,
including themselves,
the speaker. Yeah, that's why the speaker got a pick and why Phil Berger gets a pick. So a lot of people will be on this board, and of the 27 members, there will be like an executive committee, and they're going to hire staff. It's a little government.
Okay. Former Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts was one of the vocal opposition to this plan, but she has some ideas on who she would like to see on this board.
I would say probably at least two people out of 27 who are frequent public transportation riders. Maybe one of them is even a captive rider, which would be someone who's disabled. That would be one thing. The second thing would be preparation for displacement.
What does she mean by that?
Which part of that?
Preparation for displacement.
That's going to be a big topic. And I don't know if, I think we asked Malcolm Graham about it on Wednesday, if that's going to fall under MPTA or if that will be a city council or countywide thing. It's just that there wants to be some intentionality behind like when these rail lines go in, making sure that the existing communities that are surrounded by this line aren't necessarily all displaced and that affordable housing is built into the plans. You know, if you go down South End, you got apartments everywhere. Not many of them are affordable, attainable housing for a lot of people. So just, you know, being careful in what they do when the development comes.
So and I think Joe, I may be wrong, but I think like the idea of like displacement, I think that's going to have to fall to the city and county, because I'm not sure that the MPTA is going to be able to spend money on that. You know, like right. The payback, maybe, I don't think they'll let them.
Maybe one of these 27 kind of is appointed with like that mindset of like a housing advocate or someone who can, you know, really look an eye out for this. You would hope one of the 27 would have some sort of background with that.
I agree. And I think one of the interesting things about the legislation and the 27 members, I think it was designed to kind of give the business community a much greater voice on the MPTA than people feel like they have in local government. I mean, you see with the Business Alliance appointments, the appointments from Raleigh, the foundation, I think the board is going to look different, have different priorities than what you see on Charlotte City Council.
Ben.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, we talked about the Red Line. Those tracks are already there, and even the Gold Line extension, the tracks aren't there, but they'll go up Bates Ford and out Central. But when you start talking about the Silver Line, there's a lot of right-of-way you have to buy, and there's a lot of land you have to buy, and that can lead often to displacement. So the Silver Line, I feel like, is a completely different animal than some of the other projects.
So very quickly, the city will hold community listening sessions in the coming months about who should serve on the board. They of the 27 member city council, and others locally get some picks. And Mayor Vial Lyle says she's already selected two people to serve, but she declined to name them.
These are people that live in this community that I have known for years, and they've always been supportive of what this community does.
So if she's already chosen her picks, and members of the council get picks, and I'm sure they've thought about it too, and the business community gets picks, and I'm sure they've thought about it as well, how important is this public input going to be?
I don't know, Mike. I mean, four picks have already been made, and we don't know who they are because the mayor's made her two, and the CRBA had to provide their picks yesterday. Actually, five picks. Foundation for the Carolinas had to provide their pick yesterday. We're going to get a list of 27 names that today that are in contention for those final seven spots.
And, who makes the decision?
You know, it's going to be interesting.
Who makes, the decision?
It will be city council, and some of the people who will be deciding who serve on the board are people who were against this in the first place, so they might put people – like, I don't know what backgrounds they will prioritize. Will they also try to appoint people who are skeptical about this tax? Will they go the business community route? We know that at least one person has to be a dedicated transit rider, so it's going to be interesting to see who is picked. I mean, a lot of former elected officials are going for the seats too.
Yep. So there are actual candidates on the ballot this week. So let's quickly go through the list. Mayor Vial Lyle cruised to re-election with about 70% of the vote for a fifth term in office. This makes her the second longest serving mayor in Charlotte history behind Pat McCrory. The last time she won with 74% of the vote. Is that 4-point drop an indication of anything? Is it declining satisfaction? Is it difference in competition? Is it difference in turnout? What can we glean from that, Steve, or Ben?
I think a mild dissatisfaction with the way the city is going, but I have to emphasize mild. I mean, when you go from 74 to 70, that's just not really going to set off any alarm bells. I think there were some people who thought she might drop into the 60s because of all the controversies that have happened, but it did not occur.
So we haven't had a Republican mayor since 2009, when Pat McCrory gave up the office to Anthony Fox, and this election gave Democrats an even tighter lock on power. One voter, Geraldine Capel, voted for Mayor Lyles, but did so without enthusiasm.
I think by is like we didn't have any other option as far as I'm concerned, so I voted for her, though I didn't particularly like her. But we didn't have much of a choice.
And city leaders have faced some criticism in the last year, and yet the Republican running for council in District 6, Krista Bukkari, lost to political novice Kimberly Owens, and the four incumbent Democrats in races for at-large seats also won re-election, shutting out Edwin Peacock, another Republican. How do you explain that?
I think that in many ways, District 6, it was a matter of time that we saw a Democrat go over the hump here. I mean, it was a really tight margin in 2023. Kimberly Owens ran an incredibly smart and well-disciplined and great campaign. She reminded me of like a Pat Cotham or a Commissioner Yvette Townsend Ingram, where they were just like everywhere, and she didn't come across as someone who knew all the answers, just someone who was ready to roll up the sleeves and get the work. So it did not necessarily surprise me. Also, if you just look at the demographics of that district, that, you know, Laura Meyer represents pretty much the same part of town, and that seat flipped blue and hasn't come close to flipping back to red since then. So it's
so
just
that leaves,
this is the changing Charlotte.
That leaves one Republican on council. In fact, one Republican in Charlotte local government, including the county commission. That would be Ed Driggs, who ran unopposed. And some say that if Democrats had mounted a serious candidate, he might have lost his seat as well. Do you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, I'm not even sure it needed to be a serious candidate. I mean, this is not a criticism of Ed Driggs. This is just the political environment that we're in. This was a big Democratic election. We've seen it before in Charlotte back in 2011, when kind of an accidental Democratic candidate got caught up in a blue wave, Beth Pickering, and won citywide. I think that the anti-Trump sentiment was so large that if there had been a Democratic name on that ballot, they might have won.
Krista Beccari in District 6, who was running to take over her husband's seat on council, was on this program prior to the election and warned, talked about wanting to be there because we need more accountability on Charlotte City Council. Now she says we're not going to get it. And she had some warnings on election night when she announced that she had lost her bid for election.
There were so many people who worked so hard to make sure that we had accountability, that we had transparency, that we had a council that was balanced. We lost that tonight. And the voters of Charlotte might just get what they asked for, and it is not good. We in this city cannot continue to vote. There was a blue wave. And the voters of Charlotte completely voted in this election based on national politics. And that was a big mistake.
Mary, that sounds ominous. And you're the local government accountability reporter, and she's counting for accountability. If you have only one Republican in the entire setup everywhere, will there be more or less accountability, or will anything really change?
Well, the Republican campaign message this time around was certainly that it would hurt accountability. Krista talked about it. Edwin Peacock talked about it. Terry Donovan, the Republican mayoral candidate, talked about it. But it's not a message that seems to have really connected with voters based on the results. You know, I think that we've already had a all-Democrat county commission, just two Republicans on city council. So it's not necessarily a huge, drastic change. But if you ask local Republican leaders, it is something that gives them concern. But apparently voters weren't too worried about it.
Ben.
Yeah, she talked about a blue wave, but this is not a new blue wave. I mean, Kamala Harris won District 6 with 59% of the vote, and she won District 7, Ed Driggs' district, with 56% of the vote. So This is not new, but this is a trend in a certain direction.
Yeah, the District 6 has been really tight in the last several election cycles. Joe?
Just one thing to keep in mind, especially with Charlotte City Council, it's not really Republican and Democrat. It's more Vi and people who challenge Vi. Like, those are the two political parties in Charlotte City Council. So a lot of the Democrats on City Council hold the other Democrats accountable. And, you know, I think some of the people who won as well are really going to shake things up and demand some changes as well.
There may be some problems at the airport beginning today because of the government shutdown. We'll talk about that when we come back. And we'll also meet our new CMPD chief, who will be taking Johnny Jennings' place at the first of the year. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison, our WFAE politics reporter, is with us. Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Joe Bruno from WSSC-TV, Channel 9. And Ben Thompson is here, morning anchor for WCNC-TV. Ben, very quick rundown of school board. We had two incumbents who chose not to run, so there were going to be two new faces no matter what happened. And then two other people lost their election. Melissa Easley in District 1 lost to Charlita Hatch, and D. Rankin ran without opposition, so she's back. But Stephanie Sneed will return in District 4. It's District 5. Lisa Klein lost. To whom?
Yeah, well, you're going to end up having four new people at least: Charlita Hatch, Shamiah Haynes, Anna London, Cynthia Stone. It's worth saying that all the candidates were endorsed by the local Democratic Party, won all the seats. That includes Stephanie Sneed and Dee Rankin as well.
So there were mayor and town council races in the surrounding towns as well. In Cornelius, there was a rematch in the mayor's race from last time. In the last election cycle, Mayor Woody Washam defeated his challenger, Dennis Bilodeau, by 5 votes. This time, fortune smiled on Bilodeau. He won by how much and why? Do we know?
He won by a good amount. A couple hundred votes, I believe. It seemed like there wasn't... So with the Cornelius Town Board, I think there were six people who ran for five spots. Five of the seats were all endorsed by Woody Washam. And I know that a couple former commissioners, Dave Gilroy and Kurt Noss, had backed Bilodeau because they said that, you know, it's basically like a fresh set of eyes, a new leader for the town. They disagreed with some of the actions that have happened, you know, surrounding development in Cornelius with Washam at the helm. It just looked like that was the way for Cornelius voters to send a message without many other options. But he also only lost by five last time around, so this isn't too surprising.
So I was going to leave this story for later in the program, but it belongs here, so we're going to talk about it now. Joe, you reported on this. The decision in Lawndale over whether to allow the sale of mixed drinks or alcoholic beverages in places like hotels, restaurants, private clubs, community theaters, and convention centers. Okay, what did voters say?
So apparently there is a venue in Lawndale. I don't know what it is. I think I've been to Lawndale once for a down tree. But there's somewhere in Lawndale that wants to sell mixed drinks. And So that's why they put this referendum on the ballot. It tied 31-31. But, you know, Steve Kornacki might be at the big board today breaking down the five votes that will determine whether you can buy gin and tonic in Lawndale, because there are five outstanding provisional ballots. They may not all count, but they may determine whether you can buy a mixed drink in Lawndale. If there are any Lawndale visitor listeners out there, I'm sorry I haven't been back since that down tree. I hope it's been cleaned up.
Yes, stay tuned and don't throw away your brown bag. And as a sidebar, we mentioned that voter interest was really high this year around the country. On Tuesday, Michael Adams, who is the Kentucky Secretary of State, sent out this message, quote, "We are getting calls about polls being closed. They are closed because we do not have elections today. Kentucky votes next year. You cannot vote today in Kentucky for the mayor of New York City or the governor of Virginia. Sorry." I just had to mention that. Last week, we learned the identity of the next chief of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police, and this week, CMPD formally introduced her.
I am ecstatic to be returning home, both to the city and to this PD.
So tell us about Stella Patterson. Steve.
She first started at CMPD. She was in the class of 1996 and then left, was at CMPD for 25 years. I think she spent a time over internal affairs. She left in 2001 to become Raleigh's police chief. She retired in earlier this year and now is coming back to Charlotte, where she spent most of her career.
And she inherits a department where evidently morale is not at its highest. Fixing that, she says, comes first.
My number one priority will be to look inwardly within the department to increase the morale and the wellness, because when our employees are whole, they can better serve the whole community.
She also wants to boost recruitment. Joe, why is morale low?
It's been a rough year for many reasons in the department. This is something that officers wanted, was kind of a fresh start, and you kind of get best of both worlds. Somebody who knows CMPD, how it works, but also has been somewhere else for a period of time, led a large city police department, Raleigh, and is coming back with a fresh perspective. I will say I have not heard any from anyone who is directly involved, like with CMPD, who is upset about this pick. When we broke the news that it was her, someone texted me who is an officer, LFG, which I can't say what that means, but they are very excited because she was thought of really highly in the department. Some people wanted her to be the police chief when Kerr Putney retired. And I think she deserves the chance to get in here, roll up her sleeves, and do the work. I would say people are excited who are actual CMPD officers, and I think that speaks volumes.
Of course, boosting morale isn't going to be her only focus. While she's prioritizing morale within the department, her other priorities include reducing violent crime, the solution for which she says goes beyond the police.
I believe in being community-centric, where we're bringing everybody into the fold to help with the crime problem. It is not just a police problem, but it's an everybody, every citizen problem.
We have renewed thrust in the city to reduce crime, and during her time in Raleigh, evidently, overall crime fell. So was this approach part of the reason for that in Raleigh? Anybody know?
Yeah, so I'm in sure Raleigh, she was really known for kickstarting a lot of public-private partnerships, working very closely with a lot of nonprofits that were especially trying to work with young people to really reduce juvenile crime. Something that, you know, talking to my colleagues at the Raleigh News and Observer seems to have gone over pretty well with local leaders and folks in that community. So wouldn't be surprised to see her implementing some similar strategies here in Charlotte, especially given all the talk about juvenile crime in the last couple of years.
And her meet the folks of Charlotte comes in the same week that retiring Chief Johnny Jennings told a morning or afternoon luncheon or something in Charlotte that he's been frustrated with persistent violence uptown. And he added, quote, "I just can't keep trying to say uptown is safe because people don't want to hear that. People's perception of uptown is that they are not safe." Is this the first time he said something like this?
Maybe that forcefully, it's a refreshing, candid remarks from Chief Jennings. I think that, you know, his leadership style wasn't necessarily where you would hear a statement from that in that regard frequently. Like Kurt Putney, that's more of his style, but it's true. I mean, he's absolutely right in his assessment. People aren't looking for a leader to come out and say uptown is safe. They are looking for solutions because they see high profile incidents happening. I mean, there was an incident yesterday.
Just prior to announcing Stella Patterson as our next CMPD chief, the city reached another behind the scenes settlement, this time with Patterson's husband, Lance. What was that all about?
Yeah, this was a lawsuit where her husband was one of three firefighters who alleged that there was unfair promotion practices, essentially. And it dates back to 2018 when Patterson was still on the police force. I think it's important to point out that the city manager says it had no impact whatsoever on whether or not to hire her. And also, I want to point out that she was promoted several times between 2018 and before she left at CMPD. And also, a lot of times, it's an outside counsel that the city contracts with that handles these lawsuits and makes the decisions like whether they should settle. The settlement was reached a couple years ago, wasn't finalized till like a week or two before she was hired. I'm normally very skeptical about this stuff, but I'm just laying out some key facts that, you know, maybe go deeper than what the headline would show here.
So we didn't know the details of the settlement that the city reached with outgoing chief. Can't think of his name. Help me.
Johnny Jennings.
Jeez. Sorry. We didn't know the exact amount of money until he told us, $305,000. What do we know about this? And given the fact that this was done by the city manager, Marcus Jones, Mary, given the city's track record with opaqueness of late, will we ever know the details of this?
The details of the settlement?
The settlement with Lance Patterson.
Caught me a little flat-footed. I can tell you that my colleague at the Observer, Caitlin McGlade, has done some great reporting on this, and everybody should head on over to charlotteobserver.com for more details. I believe she had more details in her story, but I don't know them off the top.
Joe has his hand.
Key difference, Mike. Johnny Jennings was threatening a lawsuit. That was all discussed in closed session. They settled before the lawsuit was filed. That's why there's a lot more secrecy with that one. It relied on, you know, boots on the ground reporting to reveal that. This one, you can make an accountant pacer and find 4, 5, 6 years of history. Seven. Yeah, 2018 was 7 years ago. Wow.
So the longest government shutdown in history is now having an impact on travelers. There have been flight delays galore around the nation as air traffic controllers working without pay have been calling in sick. And now the FAA has announced it is reducing the number of flights next week by 10%. I think they start today at 40 airports around the country, including ours, by reducing flights by about 4%. And the airlines have been proactive in this. They didn't find out until I think late yesterday about exactly which airports would be impacted, but they'd already made decisions about what flights to cancel. Do we know how many flights are going to be affected beginning today at Douglas? Joe.
Well, right now, 41 flights have been canceled. I'm looking at a 10:30 to Savannah. If you're in the car listening to us right now and that's your flight, turn around. They're up on the board. There's some to Chicago, some to Boston. It's a 41 flights. I think, what is it? More than 1,100 flights in and out of Charlotte a day. So it's a ripple. But it's going to sting if we get up to 10%. And we're looking at this every single day. You're going to have to check your airline before you head to the airport.
Yeah, some airlines are canceling local flights and keeping their international flights. American Airlines operates about 90% of the flights into and out of the 1,800 flights per day that arrive and depart at Charlotte Douglas, canceling 10% of those flights beginning next week. Will ultimately cost the airlines a ton of money. Is this what's going to stop this, end this logjam in Washington?
I don't know. I mean, we got people starving right now because they can't get SNAP benefits, or their SNAP benefits have been reduced. Now we have people who are going to be missing their flights. It seems like nothing has prompted lawmakers to come together and reach a deal to strike this. I don't know. I'm hopeful it is, because it's only getting worse for all of us who are not in Congress.
You mentioned SNAP, and Mary, as a result of this federal government shutdown, SNAP benefits for millions ended on November the 1st. About 138,500 people in Mecklenburg County alone rely on them, and now Mecklenburg County is stepping up with emergency assistance. What are they doing?
Yes, so the county is going to spend about $740,000 that was already earmarked for food assistance on some emergency aid. That money is going to be spread out over a few different initiatives. They're going to be sending more food boxes to Nourish Up, as well as the food pantries within the county's community resource centers to be distributed to people in need. They're putting out some additional gift cards and vouchers for people who are on SNAP to help sort of bridge the gap, hopefully, until funding is restored. And they're also collecting donations. Folks can donate food at select recreation centers and libraries throughout the county. The county's also encouraging people who want to make a monetary donation to go to Nourish Up or some of the other local food banks and pantries working in our community.
Meanwhile, two federal judges, one in Massachusetts, another in Rhode Island, ruled that the USDA must use contingency funds to pay partial SNAP benefits, which the Trump administration said they could not do. Now they have to do it. And one of those suits involved North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson, who told us the release of some of these funds is a good legal outcome, but we still have a bad overall situation because these funds will not last long.
That is not in any way a good situation for those families, and in particular the 600,000 kids in our state that rely on SNAP. But it is a lot better than what the administration was trying to do, which was zero.
So as these funds run out, because they're temporary funds, there's only a limited amount of money in that pot of money, will the state step up, or is this all on Mecklenburg County? And if it is, how long can the county keep this up?
Yeah, so the county has said their hands are pretty tied. They are not legally allowed to fill the entire gap. They also simply do not have the money to fill the entire gap to give everyone in the county who relies on SNAP their full benefits until the government reopens. So it really would, if the federal government doesn't come through, it would then fall to the state. Obviously, a lot going on in Raleigh right now with regard to SNAP, with regard to Medicaid, with regard to the state budget, and a whole host of other issues. So unclear as to whether we would get any aid from there, but Mecklenburg's hands are pretty tied, we've been told.
So we're really short on time, Ben. The Fraternal Order of Police recently wrote a letter saying they wanted the National Guard to come to Charlotte to quell crime. And now three North Carolina Republican representatives, including Mark Harris, have sent a letter to the governor urging him to deploy the National Guard here. Which congresspeople were involved?
Yeah, we're talking about Mark Harris, Pat Harrigan, and Chuck Edwards. Worth saying that CMPD says violent crime is down 20%. They seem to disagree. The governor has said he thinks that you know, local police officers are the best ones to respond to something like that. We spoke with Congressman Harrigan yesterday, and he says he's not wanting to rush in National Guard troops. He's wanting some broad consensus, but I don't see where you're going to get broad consensus with a Democratic city council, Democrat mayor, and Democrat governor.
And there is, they called it a crisis, emergency measure designed to stabilize a crisis situation and protect lives. I don't know that you could argue that successfully that there is a crisis that can't be handled by CMPD, but that's an opinion. Okay, the Panthers regained their winning streak last Sunday. They play the Saints. Is that right? Yeah, they play the Saints this week. The Saints are 1-8 on the season. Any wagers? Okay.
Panthers win. Panthers are back.
Okay. And it's do or die for Charlotte FC. They play tonight against New York City. The best of three series ends tonight. If they win, they go on to the Eastern Conference semifinals. Steve Harrison, Mary Ramsey, Ben Thompson, Joe Bruno. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.